sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a recent interview done by Bonnie Faulkner, host of the radio show Guns and Butter, on KPFA out of Berkeley, California, and Canadian economist and founder of the website globalresearch.ca, Michelle Jusadovsky, discussing Iran and the situation in the Middle East. But first, I'm going to play a clip that I've played in the past by General Wesley Clark talking about the plan to attack the seven countries in the Middle East. It's important that we Americans realize that our country is not attacking countries in the Middle East to bring them freedom and democracy or for humanitarian reasons. These attacks were pre-planned since the early 90s. 9/11 provided the justification for these wars. Just label a country a sponsor of terrorism, and any attack is warranted. Which is also why it's really important that we know the truth of 9/11. We know that we've been lied to about this, and that there's a huge cover-up going on. If you don't already get this, please do some research. The official story falls away pretty quickly when you get into the research. Here are three websites that I would suggest for you to get started. The first is 911truth.org. And the second one is ae911truth.org, and that's the architects and engineers who challenge the science of the official story. And then the third one is rememberbuilding7.org, which focuses on the third building that collapsed that day that wasn't hit by a plane. And so here's the clip by General Wesley Clark, filmed by Fora TV in 2007.
What happened at 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country, a coup, a policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I'd worked for him as a White House fellow in the 1970s. All this is in a book. And I'm thinking about it. He says, I read your book. And he said, this is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. He said, I'm thinking of calling this a floating coalition. What do you think about that? I said, well, sir, thanks for reading my book. And, well, he said, thanks. That's all the time I've got. Really? And I went downstairs, I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess they don't know what to do about terrorism, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong, and so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists. And you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, are we still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. Seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. And I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then, it came back to me, a 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991, he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number three position in the Pentagon. And I had gone to see him when I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center. I had met him one time. He said, if you ever get to Washington, come look me up. They always say that. Well, I was there in Washington. It was a Friday afternoon. I'd visited Colin Powell. He'd given me 5 minutes of his precious time and sent me on my way, and I was bored in the Pentagon, and I thought, I'll just go, who can I see? I think I'll see Wolfowitz. So I called, and up there, he was available. Scooter Libby came to the door. I met Scooter for the first time, and he brought me in, and I said to Paul, I said, and this is 1991, I said, Mr. Secretary, you must be pretty happy with the performance of the troops in Desert Storm. And he said, well, yeah, he said, but not really, he said, because the truth is we should have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't. And this was just after the Shia uprising in March of 91, which we had provoked, and then we kept our troops on the sidelines and didn't intervene. And he said, but one thing we did learn, he said, we learned that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. He said, and we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet client regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us. And it was like, you know, I'm coming out of the Mojave Desert, and suddenly a guy just sort of shoves this nugget at you. Well, you remember it. It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments? It's not to sort of deter conflict? We're going to invade countries? And, I, you know, my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Now, did anybody ever tell you that? Was there a national dialogue on this? Did senators and congressmen stand up and denounce this plan? Was there a full-fledged American debate on it? Absolutely not. And there still isn't. And that's why we're failing in Iraq, because Iran and Syria know about the plan. All you have to do is read the Weekly Standard and listen to Bill Kristol, and he blabbermouths it all over the world. Richard Pearl the same way. They could hardly wait to finish Iraq so they could move into Syria. This wasn't what the American people voted George Bush into office. Well, they didn't actually vote him into office, but it wasn't what he campaigned on. He campaigned on a humble foreign policy, the most arrogant foreign policy in American history. He campaigned on no peacekeeping, no nation building, and here he is with Afghanistan and Iraq. It's astonishing. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're an American, you ought to be concerned about the strategy of the United States in this region. What is our aim? What is our purpose? Why are we there? Why are Americans dying in this region? That is the issue.
General Wesley Clark clearly didn't get it that 9/11 was a false flag operation when he gave this talk in 2007, or he wouldn't have approved of the attack on Afghanistan. But he did get that the coup was done by the neocons, many of whom have deep connections to Israel. The Obama administration is also filled with many people with close ties to Israel. But now let's listen to the interview between Bonnie Faulkner and Michelle Chusadovsky.
Michelle Chusadovsky is professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism. He is co-editor and contributor to a new anthology, The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. Today we discuss recent developments in the Middle East, including the wider implications of the destabilization of the entire area, the current global war as a different kind of conquest than that of World War I and II, U.S. military deployment in the area, the role of Israel, Iranian defenses, U.S. war planning and war scenarios since 2003 concerning the nation of Iran, including Austere Challenge 12, Theater Iran Near Term, Global Strike 2003, Concept Plan 8022, and Vigilant Shield, the effect of sanctions and the responsibility to protect. Michel Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on the program.
There's a lot going on in the Middle East, the so-called Arab Spring with the overthrow and attempted overthrow of Arab governments in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Syria, etc. A real upheaval is occurring, not to speak of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and the destabilization of Pakistan, a nuclear power. Now we have renewed and very serious saber rattling against Iran, including more severe sanctions, war games, threats against Iran's nuclear program. Through what lens do you view the wider implications and causes of the current turmoil in the region as a whole?
Well, certainly the war rattling in relation to Iran is at this stage the most important issue. I would say it's perhaps the most important issue in world history, because there has been a massive deployment of military hardware, the sending of U.S. troops to Israel, to Kuwait, 15,000 troops to Kuwait, 9,000 troops to Israel. The redeployment of these troops was contingent upon the reduction of U.S. military presence in Iraq. And so that a new war theater is unfolding where the United States and its allies are virtually surrounding Iran. If you look at the map, you see military bases in the Arabian Peninsula, in the Persian Gulf, of course, in neighboring Pakistan and in Afghanistan. At present, we may distinguish between four active war theaters in the broader Middle East, Central Asian region, namely the so-called AFPAC war, the fact that the war in Afghanistan is spilling over into Pakistan, and in fact, there's an undeclared war between Pakistan and the United States. Of course, Iraq, and that war continues despite the withdrawal of troops, or at least the partial withdrawal of troops. Palestine, not exactly the same kind of war theater as Afghanistan and Iraq, but nonetheless territories which are militarized, occupied, and which are very important in the context of U.S., Israeli, Middle East geopolitics. And then we have, of course, Libya, which is a country recently invaded by NATO forces and which has been devastated with more than 11,000 strike sorties, more than 50,000 missiles and bombs launched on a population of 6 million people. So that is the equation. There are separate war theaters, but if Iran is attacked, all those war theaters ultimately will coalesce into a regional war, because Iran has borders with Pakistan, it has borders with Afghanistan, with Iraq. Syria is an ally of Iran. The United States and its allies are attempting to destabilize Syria through covert operations. This is well documented, that the vents inside Syria are the product of an armed insurgency which is supported and financed by foreign powers, including the United States, Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, and that ultimately the purpose is to destabilize Syria, to implement regime change, and that from the point of view of U.S. military planners, Syria and Iran are part of the same process. The U.S. military does not plan these war theaters in a separate way. They have a single decision-making process. They view the interaction between these war theaters. They have a long war perspective. This is stated in U.S. military documents. It's the long war. It's the war without borders. It's a hegemonic agenda. It's a global war. It's what we have called the globalization of war. We have discussed and spoken about a World War III scenario. And indeed, we are in a World War III scenario. But we should also understand that this war is very different from the previous two so-called world wars. It is using the most advanced weapon systems. It is applying what some analysts have called asymmetric warfare, where you go into a country, you destabilize its institutions, you send in covert operations of special forces, you implement drone attacks, and so on. And namely, we're no longer within the realm of conventional war with opposing troops and armies and tanks. Those, of course, are still used and are significant, but there's a whole gamut of procedures from cyber warfare, the disabling of enemies' communication systems, to climatic warfare, the use of environmental modification techniques, well documented, not discussed in neither in military or scientific circles, but relevant to the conduct of modern warfare, and a whole gamut of other techniques, including, of course, biological and chemical weaponry. So that what is at stake today is the most formidable deployment of military might in world history. It's the vast array of U.S. military bases worldwide, the aircraft carriers, the strike groups, the Air Force, the missiles, all of which is coordinated centrally, I should emphasize centrally, by U.S. Strategic Command. We are no longer in framework whereby wars can be planned on the ground or regionally. When confronting an enemy such as Iran, decisions take place at U.S. Strategic Command. They're part of a global military agenda. This is entitled a global strike under what U.S. Strategic Command calls the concept plan. And these are coordinated plans using, of course, satellites, advanced communication systems to wage war in different parts of the world and to coordinate the actions of the different entities of the U.S. military as well as allied forces. Now, this pertains to the deployment of weapon systems and attack strategies, but it also pertains to air defense systems, which are of crucial importance in modern warfare. Because the weapon systems are so advanced that you want to make sure that your enemy is not going to retaliate in any meaningful way, so that your air defense system has to be absolutely 100%. And in the case of a war on Iran, Iran will retaliate. This is something which is well understood. Iran will retaliate. And the U.S. military and its allies, including Israel, have been building scenarios of that retaliation for years, because the war on Iran has been in the pipeline at least since 2003 in the immediate wake of the Iraq war. And what has withheld actions against Iran is precisely the ability of Iran to retaliate with an advanced missile system, guided missile system, which would inevitably be directed against U.S. military facilities in the Persian Gulf, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, but also targets in Israel, which inevitably would result in civilian casualties. We must understand that Israel is playing a subordinate role in these war plans. There's been a lot of debate and discussion and confusion regarding the role of Israel. But Israel cannot, under any circumstances, wage aerial attacks against Iran without the green light from the Pentagon. And the reason for this is that in 2008, the U.S. military in cooperation with Israel, reform the air defense system of Israel with a new radar system and integrated Israel's air defense system into that of the United States and NATO, so that from a logistical point of view, Israel cannot wage a war without coordinating with its allies, namely the United States and NATO. And also in 2005, Israel and NATO signed a protocol agreement which makes Israel essentially a de facto member of the Atlantic Alliance.
Can you describe the Iranian military capability?
Well, I think we must first of all acknowledge that Iran is a significant military and economic power in the Middle East. It has advanced missile capabilities. It has an extensive air force. It has the capacity to mobilize virtually overnight approximately 1 million troops. Namely, as it stands, it has in excess of 500,000 active military and reserve forces of the order of 650,000. In addition to that, it has the Revolutionary Guards, which have their own hierarchy and structure. Iran is a country of 80 million people. It is classified among the top military powers in the world, next to Germany and Israel. And it has been preparing for these U.S. attacks, I would say, for the last 10 years. In other words, a large share of its oil revenues have, in fact, been used to build up its air defense system. It has the S-300 Russian system. It has its own capabilities. It has a military industrial complex of its own. From a military standpoint, most probably Iran would lose a war with the United States and NATO. But what we can say is that that process of that war would not necessarily lead to a straightforward victory of the United States, despite its military superiority. What we can say is that a war with Iran would result in a large amount of civilian casualties. And those casualties would not be limited to Iran. They would also occur in the Persian Gulf, in the Gulf states, which are allies of the United States, which are slated to participate in this military operation. I'm not suggesting that that is going to occur, but there have been massive shipments of weapons to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. That took place about 2 years ago. The Pentagon announced proudly that it had sold something of the order of $50 billion worth of military hardware to Saudi Arabia. And there were also similar sales to the Gulf states. And those weapons are, in effect, really part of the U.S. arsenal. They're purchased by Saudi Arabia, but they're stationed in the Persian Gulf, and they are coordinated by U.S. military advisors who are there. And ultimately, if they're to be used, they'll be used as part of a U.S.-led coalition directed against Iran. So that the casualties will be extensive in Iran, in neighboring countries, but also in Israel. And this is something which U.S. military analysts are fully aware, that any kind of military action against Iran would immediately lead to retaliation and Israel would be the target. That is assuming, of course, that Israel is part of this military alliance, which it is. And in that regard, I think we have to understand that one of the first victims of this war are the people of Israel. I'm not talking about the government, I'm talking about the people of Israel who have been betrayed by their government, and a government which, in effect, would be instrumental in the destruction of Israel, because immediately that whole region flares up. The war would inevitably extend into Lebanon and Syria, and that is, in fact, part of the military agenda of this alliance. And we would have a situation of confrontation between the Lebanese forces, which are essentially made up of Hezbollah, the Syrian forces, I should mention that Russia has a naval base in southern Syria in Tartus, and the Russians have recently made a very important statement to the effect that if the security of Iran is threatened, that they will consider this as a threat to Russian security, which signifies that Russia is an ally of Iran. It is also an ally of Syria, and that if military action is directed against Iran or Syria, Russia could intervene in the conflict, and there we are essentially in a World War III scenario.
Who is in charge of the Central Bank of Israel, and what is significant about this person?
The ties between Israel and the United States are not limited to the military spheres, to the spheres of intelligence, military technology, armed forces. There are overlapping economic ties. And one thing which I think is very significant is that a few years back, the deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund, who in effect is a U.S. citizen, was appointed governor of the Bank of Israel. A few years back, the deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Stanley Fischer, was appointed governor of the Central Bank of Israel. The Central Bank of Israel plays a key role in financing the military agenda. It's the instrument of money creation. It overshadows the allocation of government expenditures to different categories of spending. It performs essentially within Israel the same role as the Federal Reserve performs in the United States of America. The Central Bank ultimately calls the shots on where the economy is going. And the fact that this position, this key position in Israel is held by an individual who is a U.S. citizen and who has a financial career at the IMF and on Wall Street, I think is of utmost significance.
Is there planning for American troops to be stationed in Israel long term?
In recent developments, the United States has sent some 9,000 troops to Israel. This happened virtually overnight at the beginning of January 2012. It has not been reported in the Western media, and these troops were intended to be attached to the conduct of major war games between the United States and Israel. But in effect, what's going to happen is that these troops are actually going to be stationed in Israel in the wake of the war games. So this is a very important and significant shift. There's going to be a permanent U.S. military presence in Israel with U.S. troops. There's already a large contingent of U.S. advisors. There's a very close relationship between the Pentagon and the Israeli Ministry of Defense and the Israeli armed forces. And Israel is being used to launch military, U.S.-sponsored military operations in that region.
And again, you were listening to an interview between Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA and Michelle Chusadovsky of globalresearch.ca. Tune in next week to hear the second part of that interview. While I really respect Michelle Chusadovsky and all the research he's done, and I really like their website, globalresearch.ca, I disagree with him on his take on the situation in the Middle East with Israel. And he said that Israel is being used by the U.S. for these wars in the Middle East. And my research leads me to believe that Israel is very deeply involved in the creation of this policy. And let me remind you that it was former Italian President Francesco Cossiga who said that 9/11 was done by the American CIA and the Israeli Mossad. I'll end the show today with a quote from the website ifamericansknew.org. In an article about neoconservatives, they say, quote, "If there's anything that Americans should inform themselves on, it is the growing Israeli-centered influence on American politics." unquote. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.